technically correct.
I should have known. She didn't like me. I don't think anybody likes you.
I like me.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Okay, the zone's not working. They're a little bit too good to cover man to man. And we can't shoot for shit.
On ESPN Las Vegas.
Hello, losing streak. Pete DeBoer's first losing streak as the head coach of the Golden Knights. They go into the All-Star break having won just one of their last seven games, and that was against Ottawa, so it doesn't really count. Shouldn't count. Shang Pang will join us, we think. We have tickets to UNLV and San Diego State on Sunday, so stay tuned to find out how you can win those later in the show. But we start with UNLV and Nevada tonight. The best part about covering UNLV sports is when they play Nevada, because it is spectacular. The last time they played in football, there was a fight after the game. don't condone fighting, I guess.
Okay, I was going to say, can we maybe clean that up a little?
Put space between the words spectacular and fighting? Yeah, yeah, okay. Cassie Soto got hit by a bottle. It was bad. By the way, what's worse? Because Kansas and Kansas State just had a fight last night, and Silvio D'Souza picked up a chair like he was going to swing it. Somebody took it out of his hands before he swung it. What would be worse, swinging a chair at somebody or swinging a helmet at somebody?
I'm going to go with chair, because helmet, at the very least, is a smaller, like, you have to be more coordinated to make contact. Chair is, I am swinging a large rectangle.
So you're going with
likelihood to make contact.
Yes, you're going with, like, you're in a gunfight and your opponent, you don't want him to have a shotgun because he doesn't have to be actually good to hit you.
Correct.
Oh, fights in sports. I can't say they're good.
You can't come out of, oh, well, all right, that's a very strange niche. Like, that, if you want to carve yourself out as,
I feel like people get hurt more playing the game than they do in the actual fights that happen.
I need you to be anti-hockey fight, but pro.
Yes, I can do that. I can do that. If it's a hockey fight, everybody has to be on the ice fighting each other. But just one-on-one letting them fight is ridiculous. But I don't know. It's like, how many times do people actually get hurt in the fights? Because it feels like very rarely do people actually get hurt in the fights that happen in sports, because they're not like real fights. It's more just pushing and shoving until people fall down and get broken up. Whereas playing the actual sport, people get hurt all the time. It's more dangerous to be playing the sport than it is to be fighting.
I mean, the best example I have is, you don't want to be that one spectator at the Malice in the Palace.
All right, I got to get away from siding with fights being good. This is a bad start to the show. So, UNLV Nevada, by the way, my favorite memory of this rivalry in basketball is Steve Sisolak, in an attempt to please everyone, actually finding a way to make everyone mad. And that's when he wore a hat that had both the UNLV and the Nevada logo on it. It's like the one time UNLV and Nevada fans have been on the same side. It was hating that hat that Steve Sisolak decided to wear. Love that one. By the way, Nevada is handing out shirts that say Wolfpack Envy, and the word envy, just the letters N and V, are in a different color, which is excellent work, because UNLV is always mad that Nevada is trying to claim the state. And so they're like, hey, you're envious of us, and here's the state abbreviation. Excellent work. Good shirt. So, on the court, though, this is probably the first time in three seasons that Nevada is not a terrible matchup for UNLV. And UNLV might actually have a decent advantage in this specific matchup. Nevada's defense gives up a lot of threes. Like UNLV in New Mexico, they take away layups for the most part, but they give up threes. Nevada has been extremely fortunate this year. Their opponents have only made 27% of their threes. It's ridiculously low, but you don't actually have that much control over it. That should sort of correct itself. So UNLV could win this game from three. Like, shooting's been up and down this season, but ultimately they have guys that can make shots. So UNLV could win this game by making threes. The other part of Nevada's defense that should be helpful for UNLV is they foul a lot. They are 282nd in opponent free throw rate. Meanwhile, UNLV gets to the free throw line at the 74th highest rate in the country. We don't talk a ton about free throws in the efficiency equation, but they are a big factor in it. They are excellent for efficient offenses, and UNLV in Mountain West play is number one in the conference at getting to the free throw line. So that's been a big part of why they've been good in Mountain West play is they get to the free throw line. They've got a chance to live at the line in this one. Now, for UNLV on defense, Nevada's worse at layups than UNLV is, or that UNLV has ever been. Nevada ranks 334th in the country in field goal percentage on layups. It's remarkable that there's a team in the Mountain West that's actually a decent team that's worse than UNLV is at the rim. So Nevada doesn't do very well shooting at the rim. They don't get to the free throw line a lot either, which has been one of UNLV's main problems. But there are still ways Nevada wins this game. Number one, they're top 20 in the country in three-point shooting. And they shoot a lot. So combine that with UNLV's pack line defense, UNLV could get shot out of this game. Like, Nevada could win this game by 25 just because they make a bunch of threes. Because UNLV's defense tends to let you shoot threes, and this is a very, very good three-point shooting team. So I am curious to see how Otzelberger, if he sort of adjusts it and says, all right, let's stick to the shooters a little bit more than trying to help to the rim. But there is a chance that you get shot out of this game. It happened in the BYU game where BYU shot him out. There's a chance that happens because of how good Nevada is at shooting. They usually won't have five shooters on the floor like BYU did, though. It's usually just four, but they can put five on the floor, and they can absolutely shoot you out of the gym. But for UNLV, the last three seasons, every time they've played this game, the only chance they've had to win is Jovan Morin going nuts. That's it. That's it. Otherwise, you're just playing a bunch of guys that are taller, stronger, and faster than you. You've had no chance. The matchup has just been horrible. This is the first time in a long time that UNLV goes to play this game, and it's not a terrible setup for UNLV.
So how tall is the guard? 6'8". The other guard, 6'8". The forward, 6'9". The other forward, 6'9". The center, 7. This is the first time that it's like, we don't have to send Nick Blair to get crushed.
Still might, but it's not, you don't have the Martin twins or Jordan Caroline out there just wreaking havoc. So it's good.
Everyone was 6'8".
So Marvin Coleman had to apologize. On Monday, we played the sound of him in his post-game press conference slipping up. He committed the worst sin a UNLV basketball player can commit, something that I am very curious the process in which UNLV brainwashes their players to not say it, but listen for how Marvin Coleman messed up.
It's just, you know, telling the league that we're here. You know, we don't want to get too high with this one. We still want to stay level-headed, but we still have a tough stretch coming up. We got to go up north and play Nevada, and we have San Diego State after that. So, you know, we're gonna take this one, and we're going to, you know, keep it under our bag, but we still have to work.
He said Nevada. Can't say Nevada. You got to say Reno or UNR. It's against the rules.
We've got recruits for the football team out here on Twitter just already, like, asterisks UNR.
Yeah. So I'm very curious when that brainwashing occurs for UNLV players. So Marvin Coleman did that, but Mark Anderson tweeted this yesterday. Marvin Coleman has done so much right for UNLV, but mistakenly called UNR Nevada after the New Mexico win. On Tuesday, Coleman apologized. Quote, "My mom sent me the interview," he said. "So I rewatched the interview and I was thinking, man, I probably shouldn't have said that." He had to apologize. He didn't have to, but he did.
He's from here.
I know. That's the better part. This isn't like some guy that came from, like, the East Coast. Like me, I never even knew UNR was a thing. Didn't know anybody referred to it as UNR until I moved here. It's always Nevada. So it's not like somebody came from Florida who's never seen UNR before in their lives and said Nevada. Hey, he's from here. The only city in the country that calls him UNR is here. And he called him Nevada. Too much respect. Too much respect for a rivalry. So Marvin Coleman apologized.
Last couple of years, they earned the Nevada.
To me, that's one of the best parts of this, is Marvin Coleman apologizing because he called them by their actual name instead of the gimmicky name that UNLV has to call them. It's wonderful. I love it very much. So, by the way, big picture for UNLV, they're 6-1 in the Mountain West, but they have played the second easiest Mountain West schedule so far. Only New Mexico has played an easier conference schedule. So the 6-1 record, little bit of a mirage. Mainly they've got to play two games with San Diego State. That will skew the strength of schedule in Mountain West play. But outside of San Diego State, I'm not sure that Mountain West play can really get that tough. Like, they play Nevada tonight. Sure, it's a good team in the Mountain West, but are they significantly better than Boise State or New Mexico or Utah State? Not really. Like, they're all in the same realm. Like, none of those are really different from each other. Like, it'll be, you know, UNLV 6-1. It's not like they're going to go 14-4. Like, it'd be truly stunning if this team goes 14-4 in conference play. But, like, at this point, 12-6 is kind of what you should be expecting, right? That's only a 6-5 finish to the year, even with the schedule getting tougher. Like, 12-6 is sort of what you should be expecting. Anything above that is good. The one problem for UNLV, like, when you look at the schedule in the future, is most of the tough teams or middle teams they've played have been at home, right? They played New Mexico at home. They played Utah State at home. Their road games have been Fresno State, who's not any good this year, has been Wyoming, who's terrible. It's the worst team in the conference. The one tough team they played on the road was Boise State, and that's their one conference loss. So they do have to go on the road. They have to go to Reno tonight. They got to go to Albuquerque. They got to go to Logan. Colorado State's apparently good. They go to Fort Collins next weekend. And obviously, you have to go to San Diego State. So it does get tougher simply because you have to play more road games. But the quality of teams outside of San Diego State, it's not that tough of a conference. Like, the teams are decent, but it's not like, oh, God, they got to start playing the good teams in the conference. It's like, not really. It's just San Diego State. The rest of them are kind of all the same.
What's more likely? Like, 14-4 and obviously San Diego State being one of those losses are, you know, 12-6, but one of the wins is randomly San Diego State.
Well, they play them twice, so that's, you could win and lose to them in both scenarios.
Okay, that, you know what I'm saying.
Well, no, I mean, if you're 14-4, you're in this scenario.
And both of those wins are from San Diego State. They sweep them.
And go 14-4?
Yeah.
How did they lose three other games?
Because it's UNLV.
Who did they lose to? If they go, if they sweep San Diego State, who else are they losing to? Three more times, not just once. Like, that's not one slip up. That's three slip ups. Then, if you sweep San Diego State
at large,
no. Here's the thing: if they do, and like, if they were to go 14-4 and have one win over San Diego State, we'll do the show where we look back in the non-conference and A, we're going to sit here and say, wow, they were this many points away from beating, you know, Cincinnati and Kansas State and Cal, right? And you're looking like, oh, crap, they were that many points away from being a legitimate at-large team. But B, we'll do the show where we look back and say, why did they suck to start the year? What the hell was going on to start the year? Like, because if they're 14-4 and they beat San Diego State, like, you're a good team. Like, you should, if you go 14-4 in the Mountain West, you should be an at-large team, or at least on the bubble, and this team probably won't even be close because they'll only have one quality win, and that'll be San Diego State.
Dang it, Utah! Utah State, why do you suck?
Yeah, that kind of hurts, too, that they suck. But, like, if that happens, like, we're doing the show where we look back at the beginning of the year and say, what the hell is TJ doing? Couldn't instill your culture to start the year?
If his opening day lineup was Jay Green, you would have flipped your lid.
I would have. I did when it was against Pacific. What are you talking about? Of course I would have. Would have been a nightmare. But obviously it worked. So you should have done it earlier, clearly. Totally Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Lacrosse is coming to the Orleans Arena on February 1st. The Colorado Mammoth take on the San Diego Seals, marking the first ever Major League Lacrosse game in Las Vegas. For tickets and more info, visit OrleansArena.com.
Check out the podcast on LVSportsNetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from BeConnectedSports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
The Golden Knights are fifth in the Pacific Division.
Fifth best record by point percentage. They are technically just 1 point away from the top of the division, but they've played three more games than division leader Vancouver. And because the Golden Knights have their five-day break after the All-Star game, as opposed to before, like the rest of the teams at the top of the Pacific, the Golden Knights could be 5 points behind Vancouver by the next time the Golden Knights play. And Vancouver would still have a game in hand. It's a similar situation with Calgary, Edmonton, and Arizona. They are all going to play games before the Golden Knights come back. So they're only 1 point out of the division lead. They're in a tie for second place, but that could look a lot worse by the time they play again. Here's the fear with the Pacific Division. We have assumed the entire season that the Golden Knights are going to start winning and take off in the Pacific Division, right? Like, they're the best team in this division. They should be the best team in this division anyway. And they're going to start winning at some point and win this division. But what if other teams start winning?
That is always a risk, like, in hockey.
Like, the Pacific Division is a bunch of teams that are sort of like middle tier of the NHL, right? Like, none of these teams are top 10 in the NHL, but you got five teams sort of between 10 and 20. What if one of them goes on like a 10-game winning streak? They're going to win the division. Like, they're going to win the division. Because you go on a 10-game winning streak and then you just play 500 the rest of the season, you're probably going to win the Pacific Division. So, like, what happens if these other teams start winning games, especially when they've got games in hand on you? Because, like, then you can't even make it up. Because, like, at least if one team goes on a 10-game winning streak, we can go on a 10-game winning streak. But, like, they've played three more games than Vancouver, and they're 1 point back. If Vancouver wins all three of their games in hand, Golden Knights can't win the division.
I mean, thankfully, they play in such a lousy division.
None of these teams are going to win, so that's the point.
Yeah.
None of these teams are actually going to start winning, but they could, I think. Maybe.
Well, didn't we create a hypothetical scenario where Gerard Gallant, RIP, was, like, actively trying to get out of first place in the division?
To finish second matchup? Yes, and instead he's fallen to fifth and out of the playoffs.
And he's also on a curb somewhere.
No, he's at home.
Oh, he made it?
Yeah, long cab ride.
UNLV offered quarterback Clay Millen a scholarship.
Millen is a 2021 quarterback, so he's not in this class. He is a four-star by 24/7 Sports. He would be the best quarterback recruit in UNLV history if he were to come here. His offers are Arizona, Oregon State, and Oregon, where it appears Marcus Arroyo was the lead recruiter on him, to Oregon. So again, not for this recruiting class, would not be playing next year for UNLV, but Marcus Arroyo needs a quarterback, and this could be it. Kid might jump up to a higher level recruiting ranking by this time next year as well. It doesn't look like there's a ton of interest in him at the moment. There's some, but not a ton. So maybe UNLV and Arroyo are in early and could land a kid that they normally wouldn't have a shot at. This year, you have Armani Rodgers, assuming he stays as a senior. You have Kenyon Oblad, also assuming he stays as a sophomore. And then you have, Markel Grayson. I don't think there's any expectation he's going to play. And then Doug Brumfield coming in as a freshman. So I wonder if he tries to find a JUCO quarterback for this class to come in and play next year, or at least compete next season. We'll see. We haven't really seen anything on the quarterback front for UNLV, for UNLV, but that I think is still a possibility, because you look around and it's not like Kenyon Oblad or Armani Rodgers are so good that they get the job. Like, you don't have great options to play quarterback at UNLV. So I wonder if he does something, but You're looking at year two as to when I think that's he needs to have his quarterback by year two. He either needs to make Kenyon Oblad or a star somehow out of below average to star, or he needs to find his quarterback for year two, because year two is when expectations actually come.
The NFL draft selections will not be on the Bellagio fountains.
Yeah, we were confused reading this yesterday. It is, because it just said red carpet stage, so it is just for the red carpet. The other stage, the main stage where the draft will be, is going to be in the parking lot behind the high roller. So it's just a red carpet stage, not an actual draft stage over the fountains.
So, like, the potential draftees will have to take a boat, walk across a red carpet, take another boat, and then go across the street to the green room?
I think the red carpet stage is just the night before.
Okay.
I might be wrong about that, I'm under the impression the whole red carpet thing is the night before, not the actual. Maybe. They might be taking them, hey, you got to go red carpet, and then, yeah, maybe. But I'm under the impression that's for the night before.
I just am thinking of, like, every award show red carpet where it's like, you guys know that the whole point of the red carpet is for the press to take pictures and for, like, one of the rivers to complain about your outfit. This doesn't make any sense to have them on a boat.
Here's the problem, though, for Las Vegas. They are set up to take a public relations hit or something, because the biggest storyline from yesterday was, oh my God, they're going to have the stage on the Bellagio fountains. When people tune in to watch the draft, that's all they're going to remember is, oh, there's a stage over the fountains, and they're going to see, oh, it's just in front of a Ferris wheel?
Is it in front of a Ferris wheel, or is it the Ferris wheel's like outside backing the crowd? Because there were two shots, one where the high roller was behind the stage, and one where it was behind the crowd.
I don't know. Irrelevant. Nobody cares.
Okay.
But that's what people are expecting. They're now expecting draftees to be walking across the stage and the fountains, and instead it's going to be Roger Goodell just in a parking lot. Like, it still seems like a cool setup, but people are now expecting the fountains, and it's going to be the red carpet.
I mean, if you're going to be using the fountains anyway, it's not that hard of a change.
I do have one question. They're closing down the strip. Why is it not just in the middle of the street? Wouldn't that be the coolest, like, look? You're just in the middle of Las Vegas Boulevard, right? I don't, like, you're closing it down already. Why not just put it there?
Yeah,
there might be logistic issues. I have no idea. But that, to me, when I heard, oh, they're closing it down, I thought, oh, okay, I'll put it in the middle of the street.
I mean, haven't they done that for NASCAR?
What, close down the strip? Yeah, they close it down for stupid stuff all the time, don't
yeah,
they?
Like, what's stupider than basically an employment
yes.
like contest? If Indeed was smart, they would be the official sponsor of the NFL draft. Nick Hague and Nick Wah were sent to the AHL.
Nick Hague finally scored an NHL goal. Took him his 38th game, his 52nd shot on goal. Finally scored. And the Golden Knights sent him to the AHL. It appears to just be their wonderful...
We got to save $2,000.
Yes. Got to save some cap space, because it's two players that don't have to clear waivers, so they can save their daily cap hit by sending them down and then calling them back up in 2 weeks when they have to play again, finally. But Nick Hague, though, his shooting percentage this year is now 1.85% with that goal. 1 on 53. But Hague has taken 136 total shots this year. 136. He was actually second in the entire NHL for most shot attempts without a goal. He actually played against the leader last night, Charlie McAvoy, for Boston, has taken 159 shot attempts and is yet to score. Now, McAvoy does have 17 assists, but with Hague scoring, there are now three NHL players that have 100 shot attempts and no goal this year.
Is Fleury one of them?
He has not taken 100 shot attempts, no.
Yet.
I don't even know if he's taken one this year, has he?
No, I don't know. But is that worse than James Harden's three-point shooting from the other night?
What did he do?
He was 1 for 17.
So, he only took 17?
I mean, after I think after going 1-for-10, you keep trying them, but then you kind of slow down and go.
James Harden and the Rockets.
Yeah, fair.
That's what they do. You shouldn't stop. That is, by the way, and that is analytically, you should keep shooting.
It's bound to turn around.
Well, we know James Harden's good. Like, it's not like it's a bad shoot. It's not Russell Westbrook that keeps shooting. We know James Harden's good at it. You should keep shooting. They'll go in.
It demonstrably works. Boise State thinks they should continue to get more TV revenue than other Mountain West teams.
So the current and the upcoming Mountain West TV deal pays Boise State $1.8 million more than every other Mountain West school. But Craig Thompson, the commissioner, said after the deal they just signed that Boise State in the future will not be getting more money on future television deals that they sign. But Boise State put out a statement saying that they do expect to continue to get more money in every television deal that the Mountain West signed. They basically said, that's part of our agreement to be in this conference. They're basically like, that's a contingency for us to be a Mountain West school. So, in a few years, when the new Mountain West television deal is up, Boise State's probably going to have to fight to keep their money. And there's an important question, and that is, like, is there a contractual obligation that says Boise State must get this money? Right? Is that contractually obligated? Like, how is that spelled out? Because I can't imagine that Craig Thompson's saying we're going to stop paying them if it's contractually obligated that they have to pay them. Right? I don't think he would say that. So I'm curious as to how that is actually spelled out. If it's not, when we get, what is that going to be, 5 years down the road? Does Boise State have any leverage at that point? Right? Like, they're clearly the number one team in this conference for getting on TV. But are they going to have any sort of threat to leave the conference realistically? Because that's why they got it last time, was because they might leave the conference. We need to keep them so we can stay on TV. Are they going to have that in 5 or 6 years whenever their new television deal is signed?
And this may be a better question for Bob, but shouldn't Hawaii start getting a little more money? Because, I mean, if I...
Why would that be a question for Bob?
Because now with the gambling, everybody is watching the Hawaii game at 2 a.m. chasing.
Oh, but they still don't put it on TV, so it doesn't matter.
No, but now if I'm the Action Network or if I'm like ESPN, I want that Hawaii game because I want all the degenerates watching that final get back game.
Final get back game. Yeah, we can ask Bob. Do people try to save their day by betting on Hawaii at midnight in Mississippi? Coming up next, Shang Peng, hopefully.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff on ESPN Las Vegas.
Shang Peng joins the show. It's real. He's actually here. Welcome, Shang.
Well, I'm not actually there.
That's true. Not physically in person, but you're actually on the phone. It would have been good if you had just not answered for about 20 seconds.
Oh, I know. Wouldn't it have been, huh? Just a little suspense, right?
That would have put me in a little bit of panic. But here's the thing. Like, we're not cutting you off after 2 or 5 minutes. We've done that before. So we kind of deserve to be
That's
stood
true.
Up every now and then. But we're going to actually give you a whole interview.
It's a lot of pressure.
Is it? Are you sure?
Yeah, it's a lot.
All right, so Pete DeBoer has taken over the Golden Knights. We bring in Shang Peng because Shang Peng has annoyed both Gerard Gallant and Pete DeBoer over the last 3 seasons. And I want to get into a few specific things with Pete DeBoer because apparently the first thing he came in and changed was the Golden Knights penalty kill. Obviously, he benefited greatly from a poor Golden Knights penalty kill last season. But I know Sinbin.Vegas. Yes, Sinbin.Vegas had a good story on what the differences are and how they are more aggressive in the zone, but a little less aggressive when they are actually out of their zone in the PK and more worried about stopping the zone entry. So I'm curious, from when you were covering Pete DeBoer and the Sharks, like, what about the penalty kill was good or bad? Like, how do you evaluate what he did with San Jose's penalty kill?
Well, this year, it was actually the one consistent strong thing for a very poor San Jose team. When he got fired, it was a number one penalty kill. in the league, and that's with Martin Jones as your goaltender. And so you know the penalty kill is doing right if if Jones is stopping shots under it. But basically, what this penalty kill does is it kind of conserves their energy for chasing the puck in the zone, and they don't really bother with it up the ice as much. They want to concentrate on standing up the zone entry. But then once that's given up, then conserve the energy for attacking the puck around the perimeter and whatnot, trying to keep it to the perimeter.
So Pete DeBoer in general, like, I think he's been pretty good as far as his teams when he's been the head coach as killing penalties off, even when he was in New Jersey and before last season in San Jose. Like, do you find that that's something that is, like, that's the coach is responsible for the penalty kill being good?
Well, he has some part in it, though, but he also had coaches that kind of implemented, there must have been agreement in terms of vision. So I don't know if it's specifically DeBoer. We're not sure if this penalty kill is going to work out for the Sharks specifically. What does help, though, is, and this was actually the case with Martin Jones, too. Martin Jones, even when he struggled, even through whatever, anyway, for the last 5 years, Martin Jones is a top 10 penalty killing goalie in the league. And that's the same case with Marc-Andre Fleury, too. They're both top 10 in save percentage over the last 5 years on a PK. And so, you know, whether it's the difference or whether they had, you know, kept with what Gallant was doing, you know, the success would have come eventually. We don't know. But either way, though, it looks like it helped him out last night. So, well, you know, didn't get them a point, but he did pretty well on the PK last night.
It did not help them, but it was the one. Okay, this is not a good trend. So
the it helped one, the goal differential, and you know it, yes. helped, it helped gamblers somewhere. So
all right, this is not a good trend. So Pete DeBoer gets fired in San Jose because the Sharks are bad, but they were good at killing penalties. And then last night, the Golden Knights lose. They don't get a point or anything, but hey, at least they were good at killing penalties. This is not a good trend, Shank.
No, I guess not. But I think though, with Galanto, if his team had killed a couple penalties, he might still have a job. So maybe that's one area that they did see with Pete, one consistent trend with Pete that they liked.
Last year, I know we talked about, you know, was Golden Knights Sharks the best first round series ever, and you kind of thought that it was. How do you factor in Pete DeBoer getting hired by the Golden Knights less than a year after that series was played?
Well, it made me look things up as I'm wont to do. And I found that this is the first time in 80 plus years that a team has hired a coach that eliminated them in a previous playoff. 80 plus years. And it's happened twice before in NHL history, and both times before, 1934 and 1931. The team went on to win the Stanley Cup, the new hiring team. So that's a good trend for the Golden Knights.
Okay, that was in the 30s. What were there, six teams?
I don't even know. I think that's even before the original six, because one of the teams, hiring teams was the Montreal Maroons that don't exist anymore. So.
Okay, so there were only two hockey coaches. So when you fired your coach, you had to hire the other team's coach.
I think there are more than two, but let's say maybe less than 10.
Less than 10. Yes, the pool was very small. That is a good stat, though. So basically, in you know, modern NHL history, no one has ever hired the guy.
It's never happened. So, yeah. Okay, that's the cool part of it. Okay, that's the part of the teams winning Stanley Cup. Is that's sort of a small sample pool or whatever. But it is kind of neat that it just doesn't happen for a lot of reasons why you wouldn't hire a coach that just eliminated you in the playoffs. Usually that means that their team had success, the team that eliminated you if they beat you in the playoffs. So their coach isn't available, you know?
Usually,
so,
yes.
So it's just sort of an interesting subplot.
I do enjoy, though, I don't know if Pete DeBoer is actually going to work here, but I do enjoy that George McPhee clearly believes that Pete DeBoer was a better option than Gerard Gallant, and I enjoy that he does not care at all that his fan base hated Pete DeBoer 2 weeks ago. Like, I enjoy that whatever the fan base thinks, we're here to win. If we think Pete DeBoer is the best option, that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, I was more surprised that Gallant was fired than they hired DeBoer, though, even though I know that there is that dislike of DeBoer in the fan base. But I do think that George will be proven right if they win. If they win, they won't care who the coach is.
I mean, they already kind of didn't, and they all they did was beat Ottawa. Like there's already been a turn of, oh, this might be good, and all they did was beat Ottawa.
That was a pretty dominating win over Ottawa.
They crushed Ottawa. It was huge. It was huge. One of the other things we've seen changed in just three games is the minutes that Shea Theodore is playing, and the big comparison is obviously to how Brent Burns and Erik Karlsson were used under Pete DeBoer. Is Shea Theodore good enough to get that type of treatment?
I think that's the question that we're about to find out. I think that it is Pete's, let's say, a vote of confidence in Shea's ability and his talent and his potential that he's trying this out. But yeah, I think in San Jose, it was a special case of having Burns and Karlsson. In New Jersey in 2012, when Pete led that team to the final, his most used defenseman was a guy named Marek Leszczyski. Let me try that again. Marek Leszczyski. And
you don't have to pronounce things right on this show. Trust me.
I can do that for the next 5 minutes. That's a pretty good segment. See if I can get it right finally.
You just trying to
But anyway, he averaged 21 minutes a night. The second most used defenseman was Henrik Talander, 21 minutes a night about two. And so that's not kind of the Burns Karlsson elite number one defenseman usage that Theodore is seeing right now. So we'll see if it holds up. I guess it will be sort of a telling if Pete does pull back on that during the season, which he might.
So I want to ask you about just sort of how you view, you know, trends in hockey, because Marc-Andre Fleury in his last 26 games, his save percentage is .894. Like, he has been pretty bad, one of the worst goalies in hockey, and it's now a 26-game sample size of where he's been bad. So you have a history of Marc-Andre Fleury being a pretty good goalie in the NHL, and recent history with the Golden Knights, he's been really good. So what do you do with, hey, the last 26 games, he's been terrible? Like, do you think, oh, he'll buck that just because we've seen him in the past, or is there genuine concern that this is actually what he's going to be the rest of the season?
Well, I think you have to look back over his career in Pittsburgh, too. And I think we talked about this a couple of years ago, even when he was lining it up with the expansion of Golden Knights a couple of years ago, that historically, statistically, he's, you know, maybe a slightly above average goalie. And so that's sort of, you know, that's sort of maybe kind of what we're seeing, that kind of swing. So he's going to have this lull as he's having now, and then he's going to pick up again. And end of the season, you're going to have a save percentage about, you know, 91.7 or something like that, you know, which is not too bad. And so I think these things are just sort of things that happen. And you know, you stick with Mark because, you know, he has sort of the mental fortitude to kind of go through these lulls and not get too down himself. And you know that he's going to come out of it to some degree. So yeah, it's just regression to the mean, Tyler.
It doesn't matter because hockey's dumb and you can't do anything about it, is what you're telling me.
Exactly. And the same kind of principle too as the penalty kill. You know, Mark makes a couple saves and we're not talking. It's still Turk as a coach. So
one thing you wrote about before Gerard Gallant got fired was the Golden Knights, they changed to a more zone defensive system. And you wrote it for The Point, and basically they stopped giving up a high percentage of passes into the slot. So, hey, you can take us through that and how you think that helps, but also B, what does Pete DeBoer prefer to play in his own defensive zone?
Well, that's a big for me, because after I published that article, Vegas lost four straight games and Gallant got fired. But before that losing streak, though, I think they had gone like 12-3-2 or something like that. They had had a pretty nice stretch, and they had taken, you know, they got themselves into first place. But it's in terms of what Pete prefers, I think in San Jose he ran something a little more kind of man to man. But I think the one thing though that I got to be careful with is that Pete is a, I think he's a good coach in terms of recognizing his personnel and using his personnel as in the best way possible. And he did this in San Jose when he joined in 2015, when he joined the Sharks in 2015. Before that, the previous coaching regime, Todd McClellan, did not use Brent Burns. It didn't seem comfortable using Brent Burns as a defenseman. As we can see sometimes with Burns why you wouldn't be comfortable with that, because he is really a different kind of player. But under DeBoer, though, DeBoer doubled down on Burns as a defenseman and also as his primary offensive weapon, the team's kind of most relied upon offensive weapon 5-on-5. Between 2014-15, that's McClellan's last season in San Jose, to 2015-16, that's the Boers' first season in San Jose, Burns shot 100 more times, 100 more shots on net between those two seasons. And that's sort of the Boer, you know, and Burns has talked about it too, crediting the Boer with kind of, unlocking, trusting Burns as a defenseman, as your primary offensive weapon in the zone. And that led to Burns, I think, being nominated for being a finalist for a Norris Trophy 3 of 4 years. And so anyway, in terms of going back to the zone defense and what the Boer does, we'll see what he kind of thinks of this team, this Vegas team, and what will work best for them. We do see with the PK, of course, we talked about that. He did bring in what he's done in San Jose, but I'm not so sure that that's going to be the case everywhere else. So we'll see.
He fixed the worst thing about the team right away. I think that's okay. The rest of it's not so bad,
right?
But the penalty kill's been terrible.
Right. Right, exactly.
I think
he can do a lot with the team with a goaltender who is as good as Marc-Andre Fleury.
He's barely better than Martin Jones this year.
So, and a good set of forwards too. They have good depth at forward. So
if they can
kind of get Alex Tuck around. I know Tuck is struggling a bit this year, and we kind of saw that last night. On the first goal, Tuck had got beat on a battle along the wall. But that kind of stuff, if you can help iron that out a little bit, then that'll go a long way for the Golden Knights, because the potential of a guy like Tuck on a third line, that's what makes the Vegas a scary team. But, of course, he's not performing at a great level right now.
Move him to defenseman. Thanks, Shang. We appreciate it.
All right, guys. Talk to you later.
Thank you. So that was Shang Pang. We have a pair of tickets to UNLV and San Diego State on Sunday. We will tell you how to win them when we come back.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
I've been saying the same thing all year long. You guys are missing a good show. They're only 7-6, but the games have been fun. Last night's game was fun. High drama. Rebels struggled at different times during the game. They play hard. They play their ass off.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
UNLV, San Diego State on Sunday. They're 20-0, number 4 in the country. You got a chance to win a pair of tickets. Here's what you need to do. You're going to tweet at me, @Bischoff_Tyler, the phrase, "It is Nevada, not UNR."
You're mean.
Just tweet @Bischoff_Tyler, "It is Nevada, not UNR." We're going to take them up until the end of the day, and we will pick a winner tomorrow. We will pick a winner for a pair of tickets to see UNLV and San Diego State. So again, just tweet @Bischoff_Tyler the following phrase: "It is Nevada, not UNR."
I love it.
So Marvin Coleman was a 2-star recruit out of high school. Coleman had a triple-double over the weekend. TJ Altzelberger, after the game, was talking about Coleman's intangibles. And T.J. Altzelberger said this about Marvin Coleman.
I know a lot of times in recruiting, people get concerned with how many stars are next to guys' names and how that helps them win games. And to anybody that has that mindset, I'd like them to check how many stars Marvin Coleman had next to his name and when the last time somebody had a triple-double in a big rivalry win was. So I'm pretty sure that doesn't matter. What he's got inside for character and heart is what counts, and couldn't be more proud of him.
Unranked by Rivals, 2-star by 24/7, actually a 3-star by ESPN. Little all over the place, but ultimately not highly ranked, and to the point where he walked on at UNLV. Ed Graney wrote a column for the RJ denouncing recruiting stars. He wrote, "Marvin Coleman's emergence wasn't written in the stars, not in some recruiting constellation influencing his progression as a player. Hard work did that. Leave the stars to 5-year-olds with coloring skills." Ed and TJ are completely wrong. Recruiting rankings are the most reliable way to determine if a high school player is going to be any good. 61% of 5-star recruits get drafted into the NBA. 14% of 4-star recruits get drafted in the NBA. 7% of 3-star recruits get drafted into the NBA. And less than 1% of 2-stars or unranked prospects get drafted. The people who rank high school basketball and football players are pretty good at it. Of course, they're going to miss. There are millions, I don't know about millions, but there are almost millions of kids playing high school football and basketball. There are going to be exceptions.
Sometimes you got to create a Twitter account to even get your kid to Alabama. Yes.
There's going to be exceptions. Kids are going to be really good that weren't ranked. Kids that are five stars are actually not going to be that good. But, like, sports aren't predictable. We wouldn't love them if they were. So, of course, there's going to be kids that are not ranked right. But ultimately, high school recruiting rankings are pretty accurate. At least they're the most accurate thing we have. We don't have anything that's more accurate than that. And my biggest question for Altsberger, because he said he wants guys to fit their program and Marvin Coleman has the qualities they try to identify, he didn't identify until Elijah Mitrelong got hurt. Took an injury for him to figure out that Coleman was any good.
Tyler's good. He's the next Steve.